Certainly good to be here this evening and have this opportunity not to just stand before you, but to be able to come together to worship. And let me tell you, I really appreciate the effort that you've made to be here. It's been a miserable driving night, and I can remember when I was younger, my mother especially, and other people that had been, let's just say they've been driving a lot longer than I have, said, when you know when it's dark and it's pouring down rain and there's a lot of traffic, it just gets harder and harder for me to see the road and everything. Well, now it's just kind of like the remembering the names. I'm beginning to sympathize with that because I was coming over here tonight and it's pouring down rain and it seems like somebody always wants to get just right behind you, and I've never understood why they want to do that. And then meeting a long line of traffic, and you know, the windshield wipers will get the water off for a second, and then it's there for a little bit. And you know, it is a struggle sometimes to get out on a night like this, but I appreciate your love of God and love of one another so much. I want to show you a picture this evening and let you try to guess what it is. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think I would ever in a lifetime be able to guess what that is. Well, say, well, it's some kind of a wall. Well, we could all get that, but I mean exactly where it's at. And what this actually is a wall of a crater. And if we back up and see a much more distant view, then maybe it will be familiar to some of you. And if it's not, we'll describe it. Now, the wall of that crater is from that partial mountain, we might call it that, at the very back of this particular picture. I chose it. You can see it's kind of cloudy and covered, and you can't see it real well. And then you look at the picture like this with the clouds not over it, and you see it. Well, it looks like a mountain, but they look like there's something wrong with it. There's a big hunk out of it. You know, normally we think of a mountain and a mountaintop, but something happened to this particular mountain. It blew up. This in the background is Mount Vesuvius. And these ruins in front of us here are the ruins of Pompeii. And you don't have to be a historian or a geographer or whatever to understand what the lesson's about this evening, but Mount Vesuvius erupted and buried the city of Pompeii. And 80 feet of ash and cinder fell upon this city and buried it, and it was not till the 19th century that it was remembered. The city just lay forgotten. And finally people began to go in there and to excavate it and to reveal the ruins and to reveal a lot that would help us to understand the lifestyles of people during this particular time in history. We're going to talk just a little bit about Pompeii, and then we'll move into the lesson this evening. Again, you can see the ruins there had a very excellent amphitheater, and the amphitheater reminds us of our modern-day football stadiums or whatever, because they would always choose a hillside or whatever to aid in the ease of construction, and this and the other types of theaters that they would have. This right here is the current ground level, but the ancient ruins are down below this. And a lot of temples were there. The Romans, obviously, were very paganistic people. They believed in their gods. And I say that plural. This is the ruins of the Temple of Venus. And better preserved, this is the Temple of Poseidon. And so it was not the only gods that were worshipped, but the gods were very revered by the Greeks and by the Romans, and they didn't really want to leave anybody out. You remember when Paul was in Athens, he said, well, I even saw an altar to the unknown God. In case you've left anybody out, you don't want to offend them. So you just worship anything and everything. Now, if you wondered about Mount Vesuvius and Pompeii, it's right there in the southwestern part of Italy. This is a very, very old drawing map, and it was right here. But if you look at a modern map, and I've tried to circle Rome there, and you can see the little circle around it kind of in the middle right below Italy, Mount Vesuvius and Pompeii are right here. And it is a very popular tourist attraction. If you go, you have to stand in line for some things. And there'll be a lot of tour buses there, a lot of different guides showing things around. As Paul made his journey to Rome, he wouldn't have really been that close because it was down here. But, you know, he passes that way and he makes his way Rome. There's one picture in particular I want to show you that really doesn't relate to the lesson, but to me it's been one of the most amazing things about the city of Pompeii, and it's this picture right here. This is a mosaic that is literally from the first century, and if you'll notice, it's a dog, and if you could look at the bottom, you can see a little bit of writing there. This is literally a beware of the dog sign. You know, if you think about that, something that you'd see nowadays, but this is out in front of a house or the ruins of a house, you know, into the seamen or whatever, in mosaic telling the people that come by to beware of the dog there. But the thing that is so much striking about Pompeii is what they found when they began to excavate, and they began to come to hollow spots in the ruins and in the things that had piled up. And they figured out very quickly what these hollow spots were because they had a particular shape. And what would happen when these hot, you know, gases and cinders and things would fall down, and they just covered the people so quickly that it would literally, you know, in just a short time, cover somebody, but then the heat would cause the body to decompose and just to disappear, and it would leave a hollow cavity. And so they figured out as they went through that they could pour plaster into these hollow cavities, and they could reconstruct what was there, you know, when the cinders and the things first fell. And so you see some very graphic pictures, and, you know, you don't want to look, you don't have to look, but here we see a man in the position that he's found, laying down, and, you know, you can just see he's trying to cover his face. This is one of those that didn't heed the warning signs and didn't get out of town in time. Here you see a person laying on their back, again, and you can just imagine what they went through here. A lot of people stayed in their houses. A lot of people thought maybe in their basements or in the inner room. You know, we think about like when the tornadoes hit. If you don't have a storm cellar, what do? You get in the center of the house. Well, the center of the house didn't protect anybody. There was no rooms that protected anybody here. When you're buried under 80 feet of ash and it, you know, hot, there's nothing that can be done. Here's a picture. Again, you see the detail of the person that was there. Here is one of the most amazing ones to me. If you'll notice, they've got their hand over their nose, and I'll try not to talk with my hand over my nose, but almost like they had a handkerchief or a cloth or a dish towel or something. You know, they're trying to breathe with all this in the air. And here is the actual molding itself. You know, it's in a shop there, but you can see the person sitting there trying to breathe with all this going on. I want to read something here. Mount Vesuvius erupted in all of its fury on August the 24th of A.D. 79. And again, just a very short account and to help us understand. The archaeologists found that most who lost their lives at Pompeii did so because they lingered too long, trying to prolong enjoyment of what they were doing or trying to salvage their valuables. The excavator's shovels revealed all manner of family tragedy, scenes of mothers, fathers, and children caught in absolute extremity. Mothers were found still holding their children in their arms, protecting them with the last bit of veil as they both suffocated. Men and women were dug up who had gathered their valuables together, got as far as the city gate, and there collapsed under the stony hail, still clinging to their gold and their precious things. At the threshold of one house, two young women were found who had hesitated until it was too late, intending to go back into the house and salvage some of their treasures. Body after body was found at the gate of Hercules, bodies all heaped together and still encumbered with the household gear that had grown too heavy to drag any further. And so we understand what had happened. They're trying to carry their treasure out of the city, and it encumbered them so much that they lost their lives. Now, what a terrible, terrible thought. That they didn't just leave everything behind and run just as hard as they could to get away from the danger. Now, this is going to be the basis of our lesson this evening, but there is a Bible connection to the destruction of Pompeii. You look in Acts 24 and verse 24, and you remember Paul has been arrested in the city of Jerusalem. He was being carried to Caesarea, and he's tried and questioned several different times. But it said after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. And we could study about Felix, but that's not our intention. But his wife's name was Drusilla. In Acts 12 and verse 1, remember the persecution of the church. And about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church. And you remember Herod had Peter's brother James killed with a sword and Peter arrested. This Herod here, that was Drusilla's father. But the interesting thing about it is secular history tells us that Drusilla was one of those that perished at Pompeii. And so we do read about somebody here in the Bible, and again, it's just secular history that tells us, but evidently she died along with many others when the city was covered in ash. Now, this destruction raining down from the sky, this heat and these cinders and all this that caused all this destruction, you know, it can't help but remind us of a story from the Old Testament. And we all remember Abraham and his nephew Lot. God blessed them very richly, and so their flocks grew, and their herds grew, and it got to the point where they would come to a place, and there wasn't enough grass for everybody, and so the herdsmen would begin to quarrel, and they finally decided, as the old saying goes, we were talking about Dodge City a little bit before services, that this town ain't big enough for both of us. We've got to do something. And so they decide that they're going to divide. They can't stay together. There's just simply not enough room. And so in Genesis 13, verses 8 and 9, it says, Abraham said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdsmen, because we're brothers. You know, we're kin. We're brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. Now, look what Abraham said. It's not like, you know, Lot was picking the only obvious choice. Because Abraham said, if you want this, I'll take that. If you want that, I'll take this. So Abraham was willing to take or make the decision that Lot chose. It's not that where they went to begin with was a very wicked place. He said, anyway, if thou wilt take the left hand, then I'll go to the right. Or if you depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. It was pasture land, and you know, some of it was lower in elevation, had more water, but good pasture land for either one of them. And we know how the story continues. In verse 11, it says, then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan. And Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. It goes on in verse 12, so Abraham dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain. But then it says, and he pitched his tent toward Sodom. You know, first it's just the pastures and things like this that are around the Jordan down in there. But then it says that he pitched his tent toward Sodom. Now, in chapter 14, we read of a story of some kings who made a raid and captured the people and took their goods and they carried them away. Well, you know, if Lot's out there in the middle of the plain, maybe he'll be safe and won't be a part of this. But again, we all know that story too. It says they took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and he departed. Lot had evidently folded up his tent and toted it into the city of Sodom because he's living in a house now. He's no longer living in a tent surrounded by his herds and his flocks, but he's living in the city. But again, he dwelt in Sodom. Well, Sodom wasn't a good place to live. We know from reading even in the New Testament how those men, you know, vexed the soul. And God tells us that Lot was a righteous man. And it said his soul was vexed with the people when he saw what was going on around him. And yet he remained in the city. And you remember how that God came and told Abraham eventually, the Lord told Abraham that we're going to have to destroy this city because it's so wicked. And Abraham tries to talk him out of destroying the city and saying, surely you won't destroy the righteous with the wicked. And he said, what if there's 50 righteous people in there? You're not going to destroy those 50 righteous with all, you know, and have their lives be lost. And you remember they get all the way down to 10. And he said, if you can find 10 men, then the city will be spared. It goes on. It says, the men said unto Lot, what has happened in the meantime? Men have traveled into the city. They had no place to stay. Lot invites them to be with him. The men go in with him. It says all the men from every part of the city come and they begin to holler at Lot and beat on his door and say, send those men out. We want to have a relationship with them. Sodom was known for homosexuality and just a disgusting place and a disgusting way of living, but that's the way that they lived. And you might remember the story that even Lot offered to allow his daughters to go out there. And I just can't imagine that, but maybe that's the culture that they lived in. But anyway, it gets settled and the men are blinded and they can't find the door. And so eventually they leave. But God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And so it says, the men said unto Lot, hast thou here any besides, son-in-law and thy sons and thy daughters and whatsoever thou hast in the city, bring them out of this place. I mean, it's coming. It's time. We've got to get out of here. For we will destroy this place because the cry of them is waxing great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-laws. And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here. Now, maybe I'm misunderstanding it, and maybe you understand it differently. But it seems to me that Lot had more than two daughters. Some of them are married, but he has two daughters that are here because the son-in-laws, which had married his daughters, it says, you know, he went to them and they wouldn't listen. But he said, take your two daughters which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. That's how I understand it. Whether that's right or wrong, it's not really pertinent to the story, I don't guess. But it says, while he lingered the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him out without the city. But look what it says. They're telling him, we've got to go. We're going to destroy the city. And he's lingering. How much is this like the story of Pompeii? You know, those people, they didn't want to leave. He is not impressed with the urgency of the situation. It says literally that these men grabbed him by the hand. They laid hold of his hand. But not just him. It says they took hold of the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters because of the mercy of the Lord and brought him forth and set him without the city. And you just can imagine they just about had to drag him out of the city. Come on. You know, sometimes when my parents are in a hurry, maybe to get to church, you know, we're running neck and neck in the young ones are dawdling, and we'll get them by the hand and say, come on, and here we'll start to the car, or whatever. But that's about the way it was here. They literally grabbed hold of them and pulled them out, and then they were safe. And it came to pass, when they brought them forth abroad, that he said, escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain, escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. But look again, when they brought them forth abroad, when they got started out the door, it's not like God said, okay, I see now. Let's get out of here. No, it says when they had brought them forth. And so they finally get them out of the city. And we know the rest of the story there, that Sodom and Gomorrah are completely destroyed. And, you know, even today the ruins have not been positively identified. Maybe the Dead Sea's covering it up. I don't know. But they haven't found especially where Sodom and Gomorrah is to be able to examine it. What I want us to think about for the remaining time we have this evening is a lesson that we might call holding on to the world. Because that's exactly what cost those people's lives there in the city of Pompeii. They were holding on to what they had. They were holding on to the lifestyle that was around them. When the danger was immediate, when it was even right upon them, they wouldn't let go. And they perished. And it's the same way with Lot. If not for the mercy of God, if not for those angels there taking Lot and his wife and his daughters by the hand, they would have perished. And it happens today. Not physically from a storm of fire and brimstone, but people won't let go of the world to get to heaven. Now you look in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. It says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. A lot of Bible verses have to be taken with an understanding. We think about Jesus saying that, you know, any man that loveth father or mother, you know, if you don't hate your father and mother, you can't serve me. But what he was simply saying is that you've got to love me the most. We're commanded, you know, to love our parents and respect them. And so a lot of times you just have to look at the context of what he's saying. And so when he says, love not the world, God is not saying that we are to live like Stoics, that we are to never enjoy anything. There are monks that live in certain places. You know, they dress in just maybe sackcloth. They wear chains that are heavy. They eat no pleasant food. You know, they won't even speak and do all these different type of things. They don't want to have any connection to the world. God created a very beautiful earth for us to live on. And you remember we looked at some of the pictures for those of you that were here Sunday morning. How, you know, there's just some amazing pictures that are taken in this world. The moon, you know, the harvest moon in the fall of the year. It's just such a beautiful sight. The Aurora Borealis that I've only saw in pictures. I've never actually been there to see it. But, you know, something like this, a rendering of an iceberg, you see the tip of it and to think of what lies beneath. And, you know, the glory of a sunset. I love the changing of the seasons. You know, I love October. I love to smell the leaves burning. Now, personally, I don't rake my leaves and burn them. But I like to smell the ones that everybody else has raked up and burned. I let mine just rot, you know. I figure that's good mulch for the grass and things. But, you know, in the fall of the year, if you're in October, if you like sports, as long as you're not overwhelmed by it, you know, there's football and there's baseball. Basketball has already started. Hockey's out there. Golf. NASCAR's getting toward the end of it. And again, I'm not saying that those are the most important things, but, you know, things that make life enjoyable in a moderation. The smile of young children. You know, there are just so many things in this world that make it a wonderful thing and a wonderful place to live in. But too many people are looking for the things of the world to provide everything that they need, including their peace of mind and their satisfaction. And you know, you hear and you see people thinking, well, you know, if I could just get a little bigger house, if I had a new car, if I had a bass boat and could go out on the lake, I'd just be tickled. I'd just be so happy. And people are looking for things in this world for happiness and for satisfaction and for a sense of completeness. But it simply won't work. You know, it don't work. It can't work. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9, it says, "But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which draw men into destruction and perdition." The key here is that somebody is striving to become rich. God has blessed us all. If we were to compare ourselves to all the people of the earth, then we would all be rich people. We might not consider ourselves rich. We might feel like we're, you know, sometimes struggling to make, pay that power bill or to keep gas in the car and groceries keep going up. But when you look at the rest of the world, for the most part, we are very rich. But he's talking about here people that strive to be rich. And we know that what having physical possessions is not a terrible thing. In fact, Paul would go on later to tell Timothy that you that are blessed with material possessions, use them wisely. You know, you can help a lot of people with what you've got, and you can lay up store a treasure in heaven. We just looked at Abraham, the father of the faithful, and he was a very, very wealthy man, but his goal in life wasn't to become rich. And that's the whole key. It's not whether you are rich or you're not. It's that desire that if I want to be rich, the lure of the possessions. Here it said, "Drown men in destruction and perdition." Who is the son of perdition? Judas. The man of sin that would be revealed was the son of perdition. And we see that drowns men in destruction. I really love this verse in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. And you can see it played out that it's so true. "He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This also is vanity." You know, I forgot who said it now, but they asked him, "How much is enough?" And remember what the answer was? "Just a little more than what I've got." You know, no matter how much they had, I always want just a little more, just a little more, and just a little more. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10, "For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some have coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." And again, let me emphasize that I'm not saying that having physical possessions and working hard and earning our way is wrong. In fact, that's what the Bible teaches, that a man should work and provide for his family. And if he doesn't, he's worse than an infidel. If he has the physical and mental capabilities to continue to work, that's what he needs to do. And to have and to be able to visit the sick and the widows and the fatherless and to do all these things, that's a blessing from God. And so we're not talking about the having. We're talking about the longing for and the position or the priority that we make in our lives. I want to tell you a true story. And to me, this is, again, I know I keep saying it's an amazing story, but to me, it's such a sad story. My dad is 83 years old, and he has one of the biggest Honda motorcycles that you can get. It's like 1800cc, 1850. Finally, had it made into a trike because it's heavy. And like I said, that way he don't have to try to hold it up when he stops. And my mother can ride with him. But anyway, he's riding in Hayville one day, and he stops at the car wash. And there was a man there that was just a little bit younger than him. And he asked my dad, "How much did you pay for that motorcycle? I bet that was expensive." And dad told him, said, "Well, it cost so-and-so. I wouldn't pay that for no motorcycle." And dad said, "Well, you know, you only live once, you know." Well, let me tell you about this man. When he was young, he was best friends or friends with who ended up being my dad's best friend. And so this Billy Husky, my dad's best friend, knew this man real well. When they were young, when they were teenagers, and they'd get ready to go to town, they lived in South Hayville, they'd all want to go to town. "Let's go to the show." This picket, he wouldn't. "I ain't going to the show and spending my money. I'm going to save my money." Every time they asked him to go somewhere, "I ain't going and spending my money." So he saved all of his money. He got older, worked 7 days a week. In his life, he took one vacation in his family. They were gone 2 days, and he turned around and he came back. It was costing too much. So he comes back. Eventually, you know, his wife left him. But this man saved up, and he is probably worth $1 million or even $2 million nowadays. But he's toward the end of his life, and they've had to put him in an assisted living home. And you know what that man does? He goes around and he walks down the hall, and if he sees a room with a light on, he goes in there and he turns the light off. And when he finds the thermostat, he'll go down there and turn, if it's the air conditioner, he'll turn the heat up. you know, so where it won't kick on so much. If it's the heat on, he'll turn it down so it won't come on. And you know why? Because that's what he did all his life. Always turning off, always trying to save a penny, always trying to save a dime. And again, he's probably a millionaire, and it's not worth a thing to him. He doesn't even know where he's at. And to me, that it's such a symbolic thing of shows what this is, that that man did without all of his life, and it did him absolutely no good at all. And he's going to do it till the day that he dies. Joshua chapter 7 and verse 20. The children of Israel have suffered a defeat at the men of Ai, and they can't figure out. Joshua has fallen on his face before God, and God tells him to get up. He said, the reason that you have not prospered, or the reason that you were beaten back, is because there's sin in the camp, and you find out what's going on. And so finally, they narrow it down to the tribe and to the family, and they get down to a man named Achan. And Achan answered Joshua and said, indeed, I've sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and thus have I done. What had he done? He said, when I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonian garment and 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, it says, then I coveted them. And I took them, and behold, and they are hid in the earth in the midst of the tent, and the silver under it. Coveted. He wanted it more than anything. Now, they had been plainly told. It's not like this was one of those things where you didn't get the instructions, or you didn't understand the instructions. Because they had been told, and ye in any wise keep yourself from the accursed thing, this city and all of its treasures, lest you make yourselves accursed when you take the accursed thing, and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of brass and iron are consecrated unto the Lord. They shall come into the treasure of the Lord. Later on, there would be plenty of treasure for everybody. Achan understood this, but he coveted it. He had to have it. We all know the passage in Matthew chapter 6, 19 verse through 21. It's not saying you don't need to have a 401k in this life, that you don't need to put back some money in IRAs. You don't need to have a savings account. You don't need to plan for the future. It's not saying that at all. Again, what we're talking about is priorities and where our desire lies. When he said, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And see, again, he's talking about your priorities. What is your desire in life? If it's just to accumulate money, to have more and more and more, well, that's where your heart's at, and it's in your heart is not with God. We're so in love with this world. And I'm not talking about being addicted to sin when I say loving the world. And I want to make sure that we're not saying that, you know, this is people that just love going out and getting drunk every Friday and Saturday night, or they love, you know, their own drugs and they love their pornography. That's maybe a part of it. But I'm just talking about loving life itself. Remember the story we talked about, good King Hezekiah. Said, in those days when Hezekiah was sick unto death, and the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amos, came to him and said unto him, thus saith the Lord, set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. And you remember the rest of the story. Then he turned his face to the wall and prayed unto the Lord, saying, I beseech thee, O Lord, remember now how I have walked before thee in truth and with a perfect heart, and have done that which is good in thy sight. And Hezekiah wept sore, because he loved living here upon this earth. He wasn't thinking about what would lie beyond. Then you look at Paul. He said, for I am a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. You know, when he was facing death, there was no fear. There was no longing for the world. His attitude was just the opposite of the good king. The king wanted to live longer for himself. Paul, if he was going to live longer, he knew he could do so to help his brethren and to help the spread of the gospel. But as for himself, he was ready to go and to be with the Lord. Again, another familiar passage. For I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I've fought a good fight. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Oh, that we all could say this on our deathbed. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. And not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing. And so there's a key. Do we love his appearing? Are we looking forward to the end of time when life upon this earth will be no more? Well, that's one of the criteria, or that's the way that Paul describes it. And there were others besides Paul that understood this thought. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 13, he said, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. See, when last November, I think it was, right around Thanksgiving, my mother and my sister and my niece and brother and his wife and his two girls and I, we went down to Disney World. And if you're familiar with Disney, we had a room at the Port Orleans Riverside, just right there by the little river that flows around everything. And we go to the room, we get checked in, and we carry our food and our suitcases and pile it in there, and we said, well, this is going to be our home for the next 5 days. And we enjoyed ourselves. But you know, toward the end of it, you get to recognizing, well, it's fixing to be time to go home. And I've had a good time, but I'm ready to go home. That it's just temporary. It really not our home. It's just our home for a few days. We've got to somehow get that perspective in our mind. We sing the song, this world is not my home. And we know the word, I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door. And remember how we talked about that the angels rejoice when somebody obeys the gospel. But the angels, they're waving us on. Think about Lazarus as he died, that the angels carried him to Abraham's bosom. They're watching. They're waiting for us. And I can't feel at home in this world anymore. But so often, we do feel at home in the world. And that's the problem. We feel so at home in the world that we're not ready to pass through it. Colossians 3 and verse 2. Set your affections on things above, not on things of this earth. We've got to recognize that eternity lies just over the horizon. Some of you maybe have your list of things you want to accomplish or things you want to do or things you want to see before your life's over. And I've got my little list and I've done a few of them. I've never been out to New Mexico, never been to Albuquerque, but a lot of people I've talked to have told me what an amazing sight it is at night to approach Albuquerque. I don't know if you, I guess it's, I don't remember if you're approaching it from the west or from the east. Hadn't been there, but anyway, they said you drive and it says Albuquerque 10 miles, 5 miles, and you can't see anything though. And they say that you come across the crest of the mountain though, and you start, and then as soon as you crossed it, then there's Albuquerque all before you in the valley, and it just lit up, you know. And again, they say it's just one of the most wonderful sights that, you know, just almost take your breath away because you can't see any of it till you get there. And you just cross over the crest, and there it is. Well, you know, that's the way eternity is. It's laying just over the horizon. You know, we literally can't see heaven, but we see it with our eyes of faith. We walk by faith and not by sight. But it's just right over the horizon for all of us. Back to the story of Lot. You remember in Genesis 19 and verse 17, came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad that he said, and he finally got them out of the city, escape your life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in the plain, escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. And again, we know the rest of this story too. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. She turned around and looked back. And again, in my mind, I can think that her son-in-laws are there. Maybe her daughters are there. She might have had grandchildren there. I don't know. Maybe she didn't have anybody there. But out of curiosity, she looked back at what she had left behind. We know that for a fact. And she lost her life. She became a pillar of salt. We need to understand once we become Christians, we can't be longing for our past life. Luke 9 and verse 62, Jesus said unto him, no man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. Well, we're not all farmers, we're not all trying to plow. But when we start to plow a row, we're going to have to look where we're going if we're going to plow the row straight. Can't worry about what's behind. And so you might think of a person that he gets married and his friends call him, hey, you know, Joe, we're going down to the club like we've always done. You going with us? Oh, I'd like to, but my wife would kill me if I was to go off with you. I'm married now, I can't do that. I'd love to go, but I can't. Well, then we think of our lives as Christians. And we become children of God. And the temptation is set before us. Something that we've done all of our lives, maybe, or all of our adult lives, or our teenage lives, or whatever. And the guys call up and they say, you know, come on. Well, I'd like to, but I can't anymore. You know, I've obeyed the gospel. I go to church now. I can't do that. You know, I'd like to go with you, but I can't do that anymore. Well, the recognition that we can't do it anymore, that's the beginning. But we also need to understand that, you know, like as babes, sincere milk, our babes, we desire the sincere milk of the word that we grow thereby. But as Christians, maturing and getting stronger and being longer in the church and a part of serving God, that it's got to grow from just recognizing that I can't do that anymore. I'd like to, but I can't do that anymore. We've got to get to the point where it loses its appeal. And they ask us, it's not that, well, I'd like to, but I can't, I'm a Christian, to where we think, no, I don't want to. That has no appeal to me anymore. And it doesn't happen overnight. A person is baptized and, he's not spiritually mature unless he's maybe been coming to church all of his life, and that might be a different story, but just to become a Christian, it doesn't immediately all just disappear. But we grow and we work at it, and we got to get to the point where the world just doesn't appeal to us anymore, that it doesn't interest us. Philippians 3, verses 13 and 14. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to understand that we can't be a friend of the world and a friend of God. Because James tells us, ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. That can't be the big part of our life anymore, that we want to hang on to it and serve God also. 2 Peter 1 and verse 4, whereby are giving unto us exceedingly great and precious promises, that by these you might be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Once we quit desiring to be a part of the world and longing for the world, then we can escape that corruption. And there's a good reason for all this, too. In 2 Peter 2 and verse 20, it talks about the pollutions of the world. For after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and it's talking about those that have went back. And then you look in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 17, and the world passeth away in the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. And see, that's the whole key, that once we give up this desire for the world and quit trying to hang on to the world, then we can understand that we're doing the will of God, that we're going to live forever. Now, there's consequences to living a life like this. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed on us, that we should be called the sons of God. And therefore the world knoweth us not, because it knew Him. They're not going to recognize why you're living like you are. Why all of a sudden you've changed. And we could look at the passage that Peter talked about, how that they speak evil of you now because you don't run to the same excess of riot like you used to. That's okay. Verse 13, marvel not, my brethren, if the world hates you, because they don't understand. John 16, verse 33, these things have I written unto you, that in me you might have peace. Now in the world you shall have tribulation. Christians are going to suffer persecution, scorn, misunderstanding. They don't understand why you want to live like this. We're going to have all, but he said, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. But this is the key. Remember we talked just a few minutes ago about people that are looking for the pleasures of this life and the possessions of this life to give them satisfaction, and to give them peace of mind, and it doesn't work that way. Here's where it comes, that in me you might have peace. Again, not peace from outside, but peace within our hearts. I'll tell you a story that I thought was pretty funny. I went last September to Wyoming to the Devil's Tower. I always wanted to drive out and see the Devil's Tower. Well, I'd stopped it. Seen Mount Rushmore since it was right on the way. And I went out to the Crazy Horse Monument. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but this man started chiseling out. It's going to be a statue, not a statue, but it's like Mount Rushmore. It's going to be carved in the side of a mountain, and it's just going to dwarf Mount Rushmore. But it's Crazy Horse, and he's sitting on a horse, and he's pointing like going over the valley. And they've been working on it probably 40, 50, 60 years, and his sons won't even live to see it completed. But anyway, you go there to the visitor center, and they've got a restaurant, and they've got souvenirs and all this different type of things. And you can get out there, and you can walk on the deck, and you can look up there at it and see all these different type of things. But they also have a little booth down there and say, we have a bus that goes to the foot of the mountain, and you can ride down there, and boy, you can get a close-up view of it. And I'm thinking, well, I've come this far. I'm going to pay the $4 or the $6, and I'm going to get on this old school bus, and we're going to ride down there and take a look at it. So I get on there, and I'm sitting on the right side, and there's probably 12 people over here, and there's probably 12 people over there. And we're starting down through there, and our guide's telling us all about it. And all of a sudden, stops the bus, and he says, everybody be real quiet. He says, look right over there to the left of that brush pile, there's a deer standing there. Them people about turned the bus over. Everybody on this side jumped up and run over there, and they was leaning over the people. That the people sitting in the seats was looking out the window, and they was on top of them. Every one of them was going to get a picture of a deer standing there out in the grass. It wasn't in a fence or wasn't in a zoo. I was the only one that didn't get up. And, you know, here's what I'm thinking. I see more deer than that every day when I go home. It wasn't no big deal to me. But at my house, I've got a recliner that sits by the window. Now, that recliner, I don't know how many years old it is, and it fits me just right. You know, if you sit in a recliner long enough, sooner or later it's going to start leaning to the left or the right, unless you sit just perfectly up and down, because everybody subconsciously leans to the left or they lean to the right. Well, my lamp is there, and my table's there, and I've got a Bible there, and I study. But my recliner leans to the left, so it's kind of wore. But there's the window there, there's the television, and then over on this side, I got a big window, and I can look out, and even though I live on the dead-end road, if there's any traffic, I can sit in that one chair, and I can look out, and I can see the traffic go by. I can sit in that window, and I can watch the squirrels jumping off on the deck. I can see deer every now and then going through there, and I sit there, and I can watch the ball game, or I can read, and that's my favorite part of the house right there, and I enjoy being there so much. But all the wonders of life, anything that's important to it like that, we enjoy them. But it's so temporary. And we've got to, again, I don't mean to be repetitious, but we've got to understand that it's not forever. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13, we close with this. It said, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." You know, all the wonders of life are given and we're to enjoy. Nothing wrong with that. As long as we understand that there's something better. And I believe that you being here this evening, you know, it shows you that we have at least a partial understanding of that. We wouldn't be here if we weren't looking forward to it. But let us never get to the point where we would hang on to the world and lose our souls. Those people in Pompeii, they held on and they lost their lives. We've got to let go of the world. We enjoy, the things that God has blessed us with. But let's look. Eternity is there. It's just coming so quickly. It's right over the horizon. And I hope we'll be motivated to live our lives in such a way that when it does come, that we'll be ready. Maybe that there's somebody here this evening recognizes that their life is not in keeping with what the Bible teaches, and you're ready to let go of the world and to give your life to Jesus. If you believe that He is the Son of God, that He died upon a cross, that He was resurrected the third day, and willing to change your life to meet the mold that He would set before us, to not be conformed to the world, but to repent of your sins, confess your faith in Him, then you can be immersed in the waters of baptism and you can be raised to walk, a new creature, forgiven creature, child of God. And it may be that there's somebody here this evening that has done this, but recognize that there's something in their life that's amiss, that they feel like they need to make a public confession and a public repentance. And if that's the case, then even as we've seen in this meeting, we've been so blessed that we'll pray with you and for you, and God will certainly forgive you. But if you are subject in any way to the gospel and we can assist you, we ask you to make it known as together we stand and sing.